This is a really great afternoon. We have an opportunity to honor and hear from Larry Snyder, who will soon be retiring. I'd just like to give you a little background. Some of it's on the slide. many of you know, some of you who are newer don't know. Larry graduated with his PhD from Carnegie Mellon in 1973. He was a faculty member at both Yale and Purdue, and we obtained him in a trade with a couple draft picks from Purdue in 1983. I happened to arrive that same year, and I was trying to figure out how research worked, so I was looking around the department at different professors, and I was always amazed by Larry. As far as I could tell, his research area was theory and algorithms, architecture and VLSI, interconnect networks and routing, programming languages and parallel programming, and there were a few other things he threw in there as well. I wasn't sure quite how this worked, but it was amazing to watch. Because it was the only research area Larry was not in, I decided to go into operating systems. But later I learned that he had already published in the top operating system conference a couple years before that. In the last couple years, in addition to his research agenda, Larry's been very focused on improving computer science education for a broad range of students really across the country. And in this realm, he is the author of a textbook on computer fluency, which I think is in its third edition. Finally, I'll mention that Larry has supervised 21 PhD students in our department, which actually makes him one of our very most prolific advisors. With that, it's my honor to present Larry.
Thanks a lot, Hank. It is a pleasure to be here and see all your faces. Just over 2 years ago, Randy Pausch from Carnegie Mellon University gave his last lecture, capital L's, and it was a beautiful and inspiring lecture. I think probably all of you have seen it. It was delivered under very difficult circumstances. Technically, this is my last lecture, little L's, and so to honor Randy's memory and to recognize his ownership of the brand, I'm calling this one a valedictory lecture. So, and I can't do that many push-ups either, so. So we have, if we're going to have a valedictory lecture, we better look up and find out what valedictory means for sure. So it says it's an expression of farewell, which I think is the idea of what I want to happen this afternoon. We also notice in the second usage here that it's praise for his uniformly manly course. You know, my compiler's class has been called a lot of things over the years, but it's never been called a manly course. So I'm liking this a lot. And then I noticed in the third usage, it was a suitable valedictory gesture. And I was thinking, what gesture is suitable after so many years of slogging along? I don't know what gesture you're thinking about, but it probably won't happen this afternoon. So I think in a talk like this, I have to thank the people who have contributed to my career. And of course, first and foremost, that means my family and close friends. But that's for another day. Today, I want to thank the people who are in my professional family. And first among those are my PhD students. I have been, as Hank said, advisor to 21 PhD students over the years. And as any professor will tell you, the best part about being a professor, unquestionably, is advising PhD students. So I've had the honor to share a deep intellectual understanding of a number of topics with these people and to watch them mature into scientists on their own right and become personal friends. So I owe a deep debt of gratitude to all of these students. Thinking about being their advisor reminds me of my advisor, Nico Haberman. Nico was the perfect European gentleman, and he was from Holland. And his advising style was very smooth, laid back, easygoing, thoughtful. And I thought, man, I really like that. And so I thought I'd try to emulate that style with my students. So in some sense, to the extent that I was successful at that, we sort of have a little genealogy here where Nico has this quality that I like so well and I tried to pass along to my students, and I imagine some of them are passing along to their students as well. Nico's advisor was Edsger Dijkstra. Okay. Who is a very famous computer scientist, also from the Netherlands. And he's something of a grouch. And what's curious about this genealogy is that I'm something of a grouch too, but Nico isn't. So somehow he passed. No, he couldn't have. I think I did it on my own. So in these kind of genealogies, academics oftentimes try to trace their lineage all the way back to Newton. It's not true in our case, or Gauss for that matter. Dijkstra's advisor was Adrian van Weingarten, another Dutch computer scientist, actually another pioneer in the field. And I don't remember who van Weingarten's advisor was, but he was some Dutch PhD mathematician, and his advisor was some other PhD mathematician, PhD, PhD, all the way back until they're only masters. So we are basically descended from the Dutch masters. You laugh, but you forget how wrapped up in computing these guys really were. Famous Rembrandt painting on the anatomy lesson there, trying to figure out how that original Macintosh actually worked. Knocked one guy completely out. And of course, there's another famous one, Aristotle contemplating the bust of Gates, which is famous Rembrandt. And of course, Vermeer had girl with a pearl earring. Little geek joke about the programming language Perl there. So we're descended from those guys. All right, I was doing thank yous. I need to thank my administrative assistants. This year, Allison Smith is my admin, but over the years, the rest of my career at Washington, these three ladies, Vicki Palm, Judy Watson, and Erica Delamara-Kosanke, have taken care of all my administrative needs and probably saved my bacon way more than I know. So I owe them all a deep debt of gratitude. Thank you so much. There's a lot of staff in the department who are also great contributors. They've helped me out a lot, and they help all the faculty out a lot. So thank you to them. This is not the whole crowd. There's a lot of staff members who don't have pictures. I don't quite understand that. This cute little guy over here on the right, isn't he adorable? That's our very precocious webmaster, Scott Rose. So, obviously, I have to thank the faculty. The faculty at Washington is renowned for being a very collegial faculty, and it goes without saying that to be on a faculty that's collegial is, probably as good as it's ever going to get. So thank you to my faculty colleagues. I need to extend a thanks to collaborators. Most of my collaborators, of course, have been graduate students and and faculty members of our department, but over the years I've collaborated with a lot of people, a bunch of whom are here today. This is an incomplete list. In fact, my goal here was to, more than anything else, include segments of my career as opposed to the whole thing. Parts of it are still missing. There's nothing in here about publishing and lots of stuff. So thank you to all the collaborators, whether they're listed or not. I need a shout out to Sig Beer. Yay, right. Our professional organization is organized around special interest groups, or SIGs, and you can guess what the special interest group on beer might be all about. And finally, I need to thank my hosts. Over the years, I've taken quite a few sabbaticals. Just the regular number, David. But I've visited many campuses around the world, and these folks have hosted me. They've had a huge impact on my career and on me personally. And I want to call out a shout to Richard Lander up here in the corner, who invited me in 1979, which is why I came to Washington. Anyhow, had Richard not done that, I probably would be retiring from some dismal university back east and have missed all the dismal weather in Seattle. So thank you to all those folks. Okay, apposition or opposition, dialectic analysis of binary and postmodernist computer science thought. This is the talk I wanted to give. And I said in the abstract that the dog ate it. But the dog didn't eat my notes for that, and I'm going to have to admit that I didn't actually do it. Now, don't tell me none of you said that the dog ate it when you didn't do it, because I suspect possibly you might have. Let me tell you what happened. Why isn't this going to be the topic for this afternoon? The answer is, I'm basically working in my office, spending the afternoon trying to put together this very erudite talk. And, you know, it's got footnotes and endnotes, and I've used a thesaurus to make sure that all the words are as big as possible. I'm doing this with the newest features of Microsoft Office. You know, it's got all these, loaded with all these great things, these editing things. And I start to look to see what I got, and all of a sudden, it's... So are you ever frustrated with computers? You know, they just sort of step in and decide to edit what you're trying to do. You know, this is terrible. So anyway, I don't have a lecture on binary. I hope you will all excuse me from that. I'll just depart from what I didn't actually prepare. But I have mentioned binary, and, you know, what would a computer science talk be without binary? So let me say a couple words about the beauty of number representations. Computer scientists' job is to represent information, or one of its main jobs. And numbers, of course, are an important part of information. So I want to talk about the magic of 10. So this amazing property of the digits 1, 0. So digits 1, 0 represent 10 in base 10. We all know that. That's the way we count. But if we were counting in binary, if we only had two digits, then 1, 0 would represent 2 in base 2. And if we were counting with 16 digits, 1, 0 would represent 16. Get the pattern? Right? 1, 0 represents x in base x. Very sweet. Now, it's not magic, of course. It's just the artifact of place representation of numbers. But this is a fact that is very useful to have. So, for example, I have 10 favorite graduate students, but I'm picking the base to be 21 so that I include them all. This is very nice. The Big Ten Conference, right? They call themselves the Big Ten. How many teams are there? There's 11. Okay, so they're obviously using base equals 11. And, you know, you can pick Seattle's 10 best restaurants simply by picking all your faves and then adjusting the base so that everything comes out just right. Now you think, oh man, this is like so geeky, I can't believe it. And it is, let's be honest about it. But, you know, popular culture knows this fact too. So Pearl Jam, okay, everybody knows, that's their first album. Pearl Jam's first album had 11 tracks on it, but it was called 10. So pretty obviously, they were thinking that they were working base 11. Except there was the ghost track on there, so maybe it was base 12. And then when they released the album in the UK, there were 14 tracks on it. So now 10 means 14. And then in Japan, 10 means 12. And finally, when iTunes gets around to re-releasing the whole thing, there's 21 tracks, so 10 means 21. They're using a lot of digits there. So, you know, it's something you can use when you got to pick a number but haven't quite made up your mind what you want to do with it. Okay, so there we go. We got our geeky stuff out of the way. It's time to push forward and look at some of the stuff I found in my office while I've been cleaning it out. I haven't been working too hard at cleaning it out, but I have worked to clean it out. This is a photomicrograph of the first chip that I designed. It's a height 5 binary tree, uses FPGA techniques to encode operations so that I have a general purpose expression evaluator. And if none of that made sense to you, just let's take a look at the mask, which is the design for the chip. And I think it's kind of pretty. It's, how's this work? A chip has many, many layers. Each of them is allocated a color. So when you put them all together and stack up the colors in a pile and then print the whole thing out, this is the design before it becomes a chip. So I think even so, it's kind of attractive. This was, in fact, in an art exhibit at one point. So when I said I was descended from the Dutch masters, you guys didn't listen, but it's really true. Okay, so I found my first email messages. So Ray Tomlinson invented email in 1971. People weren't using it that much. I didn't start using it until 72. So my first message was, email is great. Use a $1 million computer to send information the post office delivers for a 9-cent stamp. And I think, you know, okay, so maybe this wasn't my first email message. But what it does emphasize is something that I think actually does happen. I completely missed the value of email, right? It's instantaneous. I'm focused on getting the thing to the destination, when really the issue is sort of timeliness and asynchronous and stuff like that. And, you know, I think this is typical of the new technology. It comes by, but our context is the old technology, and we don't necessarily really recognize its significance. So I certainly didn't recognize the significance of email with that first one. But I was high on it, right? Email is great. Immediately, my next email is lame. I was going to make a joke, but no one has invented the smiley yet. You know, you don't even have all the parts that you need to work with. It's very sad. And, you know, I'm a computer scientist, so you try to do what you can to remedy the situation. So Scott Fowlman invented the smiley 10 years later, and, you know, bless his heart, we wouldn't be able to do anything humorous on the internet. Of course, naturally, by email number 4, I'm replying, no, I don't want to help you transfer $25 million out of Nigeria. Actually, technically, she wouldn't be a widow for 15 more years, but... So that's some old email that I've got. Here's the first digital photo of me. I was in grad school at the time, and one of the labs had developed a digital camera, and they were going to do face recognition, and so invited everybody down for a photo shoot. The trouble was, it was the days where we didn't actually have video output devices, and we didn't really have laser printers or any of that kind of stuff. All we had were really chain printers, those kind of things. And they have pretty high size, you know, large size. So the original printout of this thing was 3 feet by 3 feet. And it's only 16 gray levels, but you can sort of see how they did it. They overstruck the positions until they got a dark black, or they didn't print in some positions to try to give a white. But it was, you know, it was the first digital photo that I have of myself, and kind of cool. I had a mustache in those days, and as most of you know, I've had a mustache over most of my career, to the unending delight of my colleagues. This is one of my research projects. It was April Fool's, and I look up from lunch, and standing outside is everybody wearing a mustache, which, you know, a mustache makes a person look very dignified, I think. And so we got this picture of the whole crowd of us. Now, the remark about the slow team, this was a phrase that I would use when I wanted further explanation from one of the graduate students or something like that in a meeting or a talk or something like that. I'd say, you know, for the slow team, can you explain such and such? So everybody took the slow team part to heart. So let me say a little bit about the early days of the internet. I didn't work on the internet. That wasn't part of my career, but, you know, I was around for its development. And as we all know, the internet was developed by 4 research groups on the West Coast in 1969, where they created something called the ARPANET. ARPANET was pretty exciting, and I remember the day. So this ARPANET used routers, which are called Interface Message Processors, or IMPs. And this is a picture of one at BBN. BBN is the company that made them, and I remember when it arrived, I was in grad school, and, you know, the IMP is in the computer room, so I went down and took a look at it, and you'd ask yourself, why would you look at a box of electronics the size of a refrigerator? And the answer is, why else are you going to be a geek? You know, you have to go down and want to be interested in this kind of stuff, as boring as it may appear to everybody else. But it really wasn't that boring, because what you can't see, actually the door is shut, but at the top of this thing are big rings, 2 of them, that enable this thing to be dropped from a helicopter. And the reason the IMP was going to be dropped from a helicopter is because, really, BBN was repurposing a Honeywell computer that was being used during Vietnam War, and they were dropping them out there in Vietnam, so they just used the same thing, and the rings were sort of built into the chassis. And you can see, this is a rugged guy, right? You could probably drop this thing from a helicopter. One of the interesting aspects about the IMP is that when BBN got the contract, Ted Kennedy sent a telegram to the company congratulating them on their ecumenical spirit for building the interfaith message processor. proving, I guess, that the Bostonians can't even understand each other. So this is aspect of the ARPANET. In 1983, this is what the ARPANET looked like. That's the full network situation in the entire world. UW is right up there in the corner. In 2005, the internet looked like this, which was basically the last year anybody bothered to draw this picture because it's so hopeless. The internet's really too big to display in a diagram like this. If you zoom in, you see that we use lines for the connections and points for the networks. So like right there in front of the arrow, that line comes to an end. It's stopping at a network. That network could be the University of Washington here. So, you know, we don't, there's a lot of computers represented here and a lot of technology. So that's pretty useless. It wouldn't be that useless if the internet was the size it was in 1983. I mean, you can actually see what the arrangement is here, but those days are gone. So I brought up the issue of the internet because I want to discuss why are we Washington.edu. The answer is that about that time, 83 or 84, ARPA was sort of letting the network loose. You didn't have to be a ARPA contractor to have a node on the net. And they were introducing, you know, TCP/IP and the domain name system and things like that. The domain name system is the familiar .com, .edu, .org that we all know and love. And the question became, since we're moving out of the ARPANET and into the new, whatever the internet world is going to be called, there was the question of what's Washington going to be known as in that world. And since I had the ARPA contract, Eric Glenberg came to my office and said, what are we going to be in the domain name system? And I said, well, I don't know. What's the domain name system? And he explained it. And we had about a 5-minute conversation there in which we thought about, well, we could be wash.edu or uwash.edu or blah, blah, blah. Right? We'd go down the whole list and think about what, you know, what could we be. And in the end, you know, it seemed like all the, like UW would be great. It's very short and that would be wonderful. But unfortunately, you know, people don't know us as UW beyond probably the state of Washington. So we settled on Washington.edu, and I apologize to all of you if you've done a huge amount of typing over the years because we couldn't think of anything shorter. I think there were only two finalists that we also considered, but they were a little longer. We were thinking about calling ourselves MIT of the West, .edu, and also UBC of the South, .edu. So, but as it was, Washington.edu. Okay, so I've had several research projects over the years, as Hank mentioned. I want to talk about a couple of updates on some of those. One of them is the Chaos project. Chaos was a routing project that we worked on in the late 80s and early 90s. I do parallel computation. Parallel computation is the two heads are better than one idea, but applied to computers. And what you try to do is you have a whole bunch of computers in a box, and they're all solving one problem. And when you open up the box, this is what you see. That's 64 computers. The little white things, squares there, are computers. And they're in this big grid. And they're all trying to solve the same problem. So somewhere along the line, you know, one of them's going to compute something that one of the other ones has to have. And so they have to send a message, a little packet of information, from one to the other. And it works its way through the routing network all the way over to the other guy. And he gets it, and he can send it, send more information back. And every pair of these things can be doing this. And eventually you realize that this is a pretty interesting subject, but in order to really study routing well, you have to get rid of the computers. So focus only on the wires, routers, and packets. And focusing on wires is way easier than focusing on computers. Computers are too difficult. Wires are much better. Let me tell you what the problem is. In the bad old days, computers used what's called an oblivious router. Oblivious routers are routers that basically only take one path from point A to point B. So I'm trying to get from that solid circle to the empty circle. I will go on the horizontal direction first, and then I will go on the vertical direction second, depending on where exactly I am. But I'm always doing horizontal first and then vertical. So What's the problem? Well, let's take a look at a little animation here. Red starts sending to its destination, but then purple comes on and decides it has to communicate. And there's a collision where both of them want to use the vertical wire, but unfortunately there's only one wire. So one of them's going to get a chance to use it, and the other one's going to have to wait. So red waits and purple goes forward, only to be blocked now by yellow, because they both want to use the vertical wire too. And again, only one of them does. Gold wins. And so we find a situation in which purple has waited one time, red has waited twice. And you can see that this will cascade and build up, and pretty soon you have packets basically sitting around trying to get through the network. So it's we basically need a better scheme. That's especially true considering that all the routes have, you know, non-colliding paths. You could have gone and delivered all this mail with all these packets without any interference by just using those routes. But you can't do always horizontal, always vertical, and win on that one. So Chaos is a smarter router. And how does it work? Well, it's basically going to take a random minimal path to its destination. And if it gets blocked, it's going to wait momentarily. But if it can't get a chance to go forward, it's going to deroute. That means it's going to leave. It's going someplace, but it's not necessarily going to get closer to the destination by that decision. So let's take a look at this thing. It's going running along. All of a sudden, red and purple collide again. And so one of them should wait, but it won't happen. Red's going to go on and just keep going. Purple went to its destination, and red gets all the way around there. So what we see is that Chaos allows you to effectively go away from your destination. At the point of collision, it moved away from its destination because it was only two steps away, but in the end, it had to go four steps to get to its destination. So that's the problem with derouting. It's not perfect, but it gets rid of all this kind of deadlock stuff in the network. We're studying routing, and I realized while I'm commuting to work that there are oblivious routers in Seattle. I live north of Ballard. And actually, it seems like there's lots of oblivious routers over there, sort of stopped at the green light and things like that. They're not the only form of oblivious router in Seattle. There are people putting on their makeup in the car while it sort of scoots down the street and things like that. So that was frustrating, and I got thinking, if Chaos is so good for computers, let's just think, well, you know, the same way packets move through the network, cars move through the city, we can basically use those same ideas. So I decided to set up a routing experiment. And what I was going to do is every day on the way to work, I would flip a coin and decide whether I was going to route obliviously or chaotically to my destination. And then I would look to see how long it took, and I would keep scrupulous statistics, and I would find out how much faster it is to do chaos than oblivious, if that's the way it's going to turn out. Well, I did. I set up this little plan. Here's my oblivious route to my house. Here is an example of a chaotic route, and here's another chaotic route, and there's lots of chaotic routes. They take a different one every time. So my second day in this experiment, I discover a sad fact about Seattle, and that is that it's not a perfect network. It would be nice if we were in Chicago someplace, you know, where everything's lined up in little grids, but it's not. So I'm coming home from work. I'm on Holman Road in northwest Seattle. I'm coming down the street. There's taillights in front of me as far as the eye can see. And I'm thinking, I got to do something. I got to keep moving. So I can make a left turn. So I make a left turn, and I head down what looks like it's First Avenue Northwest, only to discover the First Avenue Northwest stops almost immediately, and this little parallel spur stops too. And so I've just gone into two cul-de-sacs. Now, that doesn't happen in a computer network, but it really happens with some regularity in Seattle. Anyway, I started to record my data. This is the first two. The first day was wonderful. I, you know, routed around in something under 15 minutes. The second day it was something over 25 minutes because I spent so much time down there in that cul-de-sac. But I have lots of data, so some days it was oblivious, some days it was chaotic, and I would just keep all these statistics. So things are humming along great, and I'm delighted with the numbers. And then all of a sudden, one day, I'm on an oblivious route to work, and I'm over by I-5, and I go to turn down the street to get on I-5, and it's a barricade. There's big equipment all over the place, a hole in the street, and things like that. But I'm an oblivious router. Oblivious routers take only one route, and that is my route. So what I should do is I should just sit there, okay? I have classes to teach, you know. Hank's keeping track, right? So, in fact, I cheated, and I drove around and stuff and came to school, but I marked it down. And I noticed that it took 2.5 days for them to actually clear all that equipment out of there. So if I had actually waited, I probably would have shot these numbers to the moon. So I kept going and gathered all the statistics, and when it was all said and done, I took the oblivious numbers and the chaotic numbers, and I figured their averages. And in fact, it happens that you do pick up about 3 minutes on my commute from the university home. But there's an update. And that was in the early 90s, and I just sort of repeated some of those numbers. And this is the exact same trip, but under the current circumstances, because Seattle's got lots more traffic, and of course they very nicely put up a whole lot more stop signs, stop lights, you know, do not enter, and everything else. So oblivious is still worse than chaotic. You want to do chaotic, but we'd love to go back to the good old days when you could ride around Seattle and all there were just green vehicles stopped at the green lights. So that's the situation with the Chaos Project. I'll mention one other project, a little update on it. This is the ZPL programming language project. We started this in 93, and we were working on it for several years, publishing papers, writing a compiler, and having a pretty good time. And all of a sudden, one day, we get a nasty gram from some attorneys in the Midwest that say that we are infringing on their trademark, and we should cease and desist. And the attorneys were representing an outfit called the Zebra Technologies. Zebra Technologies had a language called ZPL, the Zebra programming language, and they used it to program barcodes. So, you know, we go to the grocery store, all those barcodes on the shelves have to be printed by something, and it's a Zebra printer probably that does it. And to say what you, how the form of the barcode goes, you have to write in their language. So people would, people use ZPL, they trademarked it, and so they said we were infringing. And, you know, we said, what? Come on. So the Attorney General represents the University of Washington in cases like this. So the AG's office hired some fancy attorneys and sent them a nasty gram back. And it said, wait a second, you got a barcode printer language. We got a supercomputer language. Supercomputers don't print barcodes. They're different. There's no confusion. So we thought that was the end of it. They didn't write back, they didn't contest anything, so we thought that was pretty smooth. Unfortunately, every year, about once a year, we get some frantic email from some person who's trying to print their fancy barcode. and they write this very sad note, you know, could you help me with my smart label? And, you know, we don't know anything about this language. So we have to write back and, you know, a very kind note saying we're awfully sorry, but ours is a supercomputer language. That's different than your barcode language. This is what you want. There's no confusion according to our lawyers. So let's see. There's one more thing about the ZPL project I want to mention. If you go to the people page on the ZPL site, you'll come across pictures like this. And under my picture, you're going to see something that says World's Worst Programmer. Now, I didn't put that under there. Some person or persons unknown did. They're almost certainly visible on this page, I suspect. And I'm thinking, World's Worst Programmer, you know, that's a pretty sweeping statement, World's Worst, or is this like the World Series? It just applies in North America, you know, there's really crappy programmers out there someplace else. And who said? I mean, did you vote for the World's Worst Programmer? You know, you vote on American Idol. I think we should have been notified that we could vote for the World's Worst Programmer. And so I think this is really sort of inaccurate, you know, and I'm troubled that it remains. So this afternoon, in the presence of all my friends, I would like to assert that I want this corrected so that it's a little bit more accurate. I am World's Worst Programmer Emeritus. And see, I'll get out of the way and somebody else can step up, so go for it. Okay, so let's talk about computer speeds for just a second here. Parallel computers are intended to make computers go faster, and one measure of computer speed is floating point operations per second, or FLOPS. Now, you know, it's a terrible word, but it's the technically correct word. And what's a floating point operation? Well, it's basically decimal arithmetic. You multiply two decimal numbers, you add two decimal numbers, or something like that. And that's a floating point operation. You just count up how many they do in a second, and that's where you are. So when I got interested in this subject initially, the Cray-1 could run at 133 megaflops, million floating point operations per second. So, you know, that's a lot of decimal arithmetic in 1 second. But it was not as fast as computers could go, and of course that meant that there had to be a new goal of trying to go faster. So the goal became to go at 1 gigaflops. Which is a billion floating point operations per second, and that was achieved in 1988. And then we pushed on to 1 teraflops, trillion floating point operations, that was 1998. So, you know, things are basically clicking off here. The next goal, petaflops, don't pick these names, they're the official terms for these big numbers, is 1,000 trillion floating point operations per second, and that's where we are now. The world's fastest computer goes at 1.76 petaflops at this point. So having achieved that, what's the next goal? Exaflops. So that's 1 million trillion floating point operations per second. And, you know, nobody in this room, none of us can comprehend these numbers. So one way to look at them, though, is see how fast you could improve computation. So imagine that you have a 1 gigaflops computer, which is what probably most of your computers can do at this point. And you have a computation that takes 1,000 years. Well, if you have a teraflop computer, it only takes 1 year. And if you have a petaflop machine, it will only take 8 hours. And down there at the bottom, kind of chopped off, it says if you had an exaflop machine, it would take just 1 second. So that's pretty good speed. But, you know, even if we achieve exaflops, are we going to quit there? Nah. So what comes next? So after exaflops comes zettaflops, which is 1 billion trillion floating point operations per second. And after zettaflops comes yottaflops, trillion trillion floating point operations per second. I mean, you know, at that point, probably this computer will compute everything everybody wants in a second, and we're done. You know, there's nothing more to do. So it's just yada, yada, yada from there on out. So speed, that's what we're for. Okay, I want to say something about first computers. So, okay, a lot of computer scientists are kind of geeky, and they occasionally mention, maybe at a cocktail party or something, the first computer they ever used. I shouldn't admit that, should I? Okay, they talk about what's their first computer, and, you know, my first computer was an IBM PC, or it was a TRS-80, or there's a big following for, you know, Apple IIe's and stuff like that. In these discussions, I sort of feel like, you know, Crocodile Dundee, you know, Paul Hogan, you know, this is not a computer. This is a computer. And the way you know it's a computer is you can walk around among its parts. You know, it doesn't come in a box, it comes in a truck. And it's not part of a telephone, there's a telephone sitting on it, and that's a direct line to the people who will fix it, because there's a team standing around waiting to fix it 24/7. So this is the 7040. This is the first computer I used. This is a little bit easier picture to see what all we have here. So this is the actual computer part. 5 cabinets, and the computer is actually in here. It's memory and it's processing unit and so forth. These guys over here on the side are channels. They are the part that connects the computer with everything else in the room. And you have to have special equipment for that. Obviously, we have tape drives. This guy is a combination card reader and card punch. And back here is a printer. And I don't know why it's in this picture, because this is the only configuration of the 7040 I've ever seen that has a printer with it. Normally, they don't have printers. They do have card reader, and I'll explain why in just a second. So there we have it. Now, this is a picture of me within the first 2 weeks of my first job running this computer. It's a publicity picture, because human beings were not actually allowed in the computer room, only computer operators like me. And these two guys were in here for some purpose, I don't know what, but they were trying to look very technical. And the way that you know they're not technical is they're reading the console log upside down. The The way you know I have a big future in engineering despite not even being in college yet is I'm wearing plaid. Okay, so this is we got lots of boxes around, but that's not the only computer in the room. There's another computer in the room to feed that computer, and that's the 1401. It prepares the input for the 7040 and it prints the output for the 7040. It's a helper computer, okay? I'll explain it in a second, but you know, this is a marketing photo from IBM, a company that is known to be very straight-laced. But as I look at this picture, you know, it looks like South Pacific, you know, some enchanted evening, you know, across a crowded room. Except the room is crowded with electronic boxes, you know, here. What is all this stuff? Here's the computer. It's about the size of a dumpster. It's a very tiny computer, despite being enormous. It has more tape drives. We have another punch and card reader over here. And we have the printer here. And she seems to be pointing at some output, so we don't know what's going on here. It's a small computer, and the question is, how small is it? Well, it has 4,096 characters. The word bytes hadn't been invented yet, and characters in this machine were only 6 bits. And to give you an idea how much 4,096 is, in your browser, on the location line, when you type in HTTP, blah, 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 you get to have 4,096 characters out there in that field. Not that anybody ever types them, but if you did, it would fill up this computer. So we use memory much more casually than they did in those days. Okay, so there was one other gadget in the room, which was a disk storage device, hard disk, called the 1301. It had 28 million bytes. Again, these are the little 6-bit bytes, not the 8-bit guys. It cost $842,000 in current money, so that figures out to 3 cents a byte. By comparison, this is the Western Digital Elements external hard drive. It has 2 trillion bytes. They're real bytes. It costs $139. So it's about 6 billionths of a penny per byte. So there has been some advance here in hard disk. But I'll tell you, the 1301, you know, it would really roar when it started up. So it was a whole lot more fun. Okay, here's the front panel. So I, you know, in my job, I looked at this all the time. There's the instruction register across the top. Whatever instruction is being executed, it's shown there in lights. And when the machine crashes, it did that all the time. The machine, the instruction it quit on, is shown there in the lights. If you're going to add a couple of numbers together, one of them goes there, the other one goes there. You add them together, and the result goes back in the accumulator. If you're doing a multiplication, you need that register. We have a reset button. We all know that when your computer is wedged and you have to clear memory, you should just turn it off or unplug it or stop the power, because then the memory goes to zero. That didn't work in those days because we had magnetic memory. The brown stuff in these pictures, second cabinet back, is the 32,000 words of magnetic memory. And when you turn the power off, it still stays magnetized. So we had a reset button that would set it to zero. So that was what that button was for. We have a load button. We have a start button. Real computers have start buttons. We have an emergency button. When the thing starts sparking and there are these big arcs going across, okay, pull this thing out because you need to cut off power fast. And then down here at the bottom, we have the instruction keys, and I'll show you how those guys work right now. So here's an enlargement of a 7040 operator doing my job, and it's a little hard to see, but I bet you can probably tell that in that first column of keys that he's in front of there, it's the bottom key that's depressed. Okay, there are 8 keys in the column. The bottom one is depressed. The one to the right, next column, the top one is depressed. And then the next column, the 6th key, the second down, is depressed. And he's about to hit the number 2. So the number he's typing in is 0762-03001210. That's the octal sequence for the instruction read select channel A for this computer. You can't run this computer unless you know that magic number, 0762-03001210. So my job was to run programs, right? And so the question is, how hard is it to run programs? You know, we all run programs all the time. You know, you get the power on, you basically hunt around for your app, you hit your app, and, you know, presto, it runs, and you see your result. What was I doing? virtually everything I did was locked up in this click right there. So let me show you what it's like inside the click. First thing is you have to power the computer up. Well, you do, it goes ka-chunk, and then everything comes on because none of this equipment had a start, had a power button. It was all directly wired to the building supply at the breaker box. And so to start all the equipment up, you would go to the breaker box and you'd basically set the power on and the entire room would light up and all the machines would start going and the fans would start whirring and stuff like that. It was very exciting. So that would get the machine going. Now, your app has to be, of course, written out on punch cards. So you then stick them in the card reader like this guy is doing at the University of Waterloo. And then you go over, and this is for the 1401. Now, please don't be distracted by these two passionate geeks. The cards go down the slot. They go by signals over to the 1401. The 1401 encodes them for a tape drive, and they get written onto the tape drive over there on the far side. Next thing, you grab the tape and you take it over to the other computer because these have separate tape drives. They're unconnected computers. So you mount the tape, and now what you do is go through a boot sequence. And the first step is to hit reset, right? Because we've got the magnetic memory, you got to hit reset. Then you load the boot cards into the card reader. That's what this woman is doing there. It's about 25 cards, and it's a little short program, and I'll explain it in a second. She puts it in the card reader, she punches ready, and the thing is ready to read those cards. The guy sits there at the console. You've already seen him. He dials in 0762-03001210. The magic read select command. He presses load. That puts that number into the computer. He presses start. The computer does what the instruction says, and that instruction says read the cards in the card reader. So now we're booting the computer. The load start causes the instruction to be loaded and run. The instruction causes the cards to be loaded and run. That's a little tiny program that causes the operating system to be loaded and run. And of course, the operating system causes your program to be loaded and run. So starting out from that one little start punch to read the instructions, read the cards, read the OS, that bootstrapping operation is where we get the word boot this day and age. So voila. You have run a program. You don't have your output yet, but you run your program. Your output is over here on this blue tape because, remember, this computer doesn't really have a printer or anything like that. So what do? You grab the tape and you go back to the other computer and you change the tape and put it on that machine. You ignore the geeks for a second. The signals go off the tape through cables under the floor. You have to boot this computer too. I left this part out, but you have to boot this one as well because they're all computers. They're clear inside. There's nothing happening. And so the signals go into the 1401, they get processed to printer signals, and presto, the result comes out on the printer, and you find out what she's pointing to. So this process is basically what happened inside the click. So running programs then and now, it's basically the fact that technical developments have modified some of the steps slightly. You don't have to boot the operating system every time you want to run a program. And that helps things somewhat. And we know nowadays that the input is oftentimes keystrokes or clicks or something like that, although it could be characters. And the output is often video or audio and so forth. But in principle, everything that I did in those days is exactly what we're doing when we boot up our smartphones and run programs or use our laptops or desktops or whatever. So that hasn't changed much. In this talk, I've talked a lot about stuff that has changed. Computer speeds, silicon technologies, disk prices, dot, dot, dot. All these technologies have changed, but I would say that basically, you know, those are very obvious changes, but they're really not that important. I think the thing that seems to me to be significant is that society has changed. So when I was working at the Computer Center and giving dignitaries these tours, and I would basically show them how a program runs, just like you saw how a program runs. I would, you know, give my little spiel, but the people listening didn't have any vocabulary. They didn't know binary or algorithm or boot or operating system or any of these terms that we're familiar with. In those days, computers were associated with calculators, so, you know, they thought of calculators mechanical, so that, you know, they're sort of thinking that way. all the machines that they knew had moving parts inside of them. And there was very little awareness of what a computer even did, or the fact that it needed input or it would produce output. And so, you know, I would sit there or stand there and I would give the demo, and these dignitaries would sort of watch the tapes going around, okay? And that was the mechanical part. So whatever was happening must involve these tapes, which, of course, peripherally it did, but, you know, the action's inside those five big boxes. So, you know, society was just not very computational. Nowadays, you know, our society not only makes daily use of computers and all the technologies that they enable, but, you know, we've acquired some computational terms, some concepts, just from our use of computers and being in a society in which computation is used all the time. And we use all these things in our unconscious thinking. So I would say that our society really has a lot of ambient computer knowledge that we can rely on. And that's changed over my career a lot. And it's been one of, I think, the rewarding changes because, you know, I was excited in 1964 at the beginning of my career about computers and wanted to tell somebody about it, but you couldn't share this stuff with anybody because they had no idea what was going on. But now here it is, you know, end of my career, and the whole society all understands computers at some level, and it is possible to share the excitement. So I think this has been actually a really wonderful change over my career. Not the price of disk space, but the fact that, you know, computing has become something that everybody knows a little bit about. There is a postscript to the 7040. Computers officially dead, buried, and fossilized when its number is recycled. The IBM 70, let me introduce the IBM 7040E server here. So this is a machine that uses the same one. You can think of it as resurrecting the old computer that I used, although this one has no buttons on it or lights or actually any of the fun stuff. So that is the 7040. Let me wrap up my microcentury here by giving the top 10 reasons to be a CS prof. I'm channeling David Letterman here, you know, the top 10 reasons to be a CS prof. And I realize that I am the person standing between you and refreshments. So let me do this very, very fast, okay? So number 10, computer science is fascinating. And number 1, computer science is fun.
Thanks, Larry. I think you've set a challenge for all the people to follow after you. Usually in the past, when somebody retires, we give them a lot of abuse, but don't require them to do anything. And now you've set a new threshold. Right, we set a new bar. I want to give you a framed copy of the invitation to this talk that we send out as a gift. There will be some other things later.
I appreciate it.
And I want to thank you so much for that talk, which was really fun. And for some of us of a certain age, brought back a lot of memories. So thank you very much for this great turnout.